Hey everybody, welcome back to episode 10 of the Percy Jackson Poseidon podcast. This is going to be the part 1 review for book 4, Percy Jackson and the Olympians, The Battle of the Labyrinth. So, going into this book, the only thing I had remembered was that we're in the famous labyrinth from the Myth of the Minotaur, and we meet Daedalus. And that's literally all I knew. So, reading this, there were definitely a lot of surprises going into it. And this opening chapter, the book starts with Percy going to a new school orientation. And his mom, Sally, mentions that he has a date with Annabeth. And Percy is kind of quick to say, oh, no, it's not a date. You know, and I do like this teenage kind of point of view about Percy and Annabeth liking each other, but like kind of being really awkward about it. I think it's really cute. But, you know, Percy goes to this new school because Sally's new boyfriend, Paul Blofus, who we met in the last book, is a teacher there. And so the cool thing about this opening is that Percy ends up running into Rachel Elizabeth Dare, who we met at the Hoover Dam in the last book, The Titan's Curse. So that's kind of cool that I didn't remember if we ever had brought her back in the story, and we do bring her back, so I kind of like that. And so, you know, Percy then approached by two presumably cheerleaders, but Rachel tells him to run because she can see through the mist, and she knows that they're monsters, actually. And so it turns out the two cheerleaders are Impusai, which are like these blood-sucking monsters that have like the leg of an animal and one leg of a robot or something. And they're kind of like vampires that can like enthrall men and stuff. So that's kind of cool. And Rachel is there to help Percy kind of snap out of their thrall, which is good. And he ends up killing one of them, but then just before he can kill the other one, she bursts into flames right in front of a group of people who were touring the school. So obviously Percy's in trouble, the fire alarm's going off, so he and Rachel escape out the back. Percy runs to the back alley, he ends up running into Annabeth, and it's kind of a little funny, awkward moment where Annabeth is like kind of jealous of Rachel, you know, because Rachel writes her phone number on Percy's arm, and, you know, I like Annabeth's like, oh, she's cute, and Percy's like, is she? I don't know. So it's kind of just shows how, like, clueless Percy really is, like, about girls and stuff, but, like, Annabeth clearly has an interest in him. So I kind of do like those little, just sort of nods of teen romance building between Percy and Annabeth. And so Percy and Annabeth decide to go to Camp Half-Blood. And we see Grover is on trial by the Counselor of the Cloven Elders for claiming to commune with Pan, the god of the wild. Because last book, Grover drank a bunch of coffee and he says, oh, I heard from Pan. So now they're kind of like, he's a little in trouble for that. So Grover is told that he has 1 week to prove his claims or they'll take away his searcher's license. And that's kind of a big deal because since the first book, that's the whole thing we've been building up to. It's like Grover's whole mission in life is the searcher's license and to find Pan. And so I like that we're continuing his story at the beginning of this as well. And we also find out Grover has a girlfriend named Juniper, who's a dryad. And then we get the return of Tyson to Camp Half-Blood also. So it's nice to see him again. He was, I think, mentioned or briefly seen an Iris message, I think, in the last book, but we really haven't seen him since the second book, so I like that we're getting Tyson again here, and that, you know, he is Percy's roommate, but also, you know, he kind of doesn't really like satyrs that much, and Grover doesn't really like him that much, and there's still a little bit of animosity with the group and Tyson, but things are a lot better than what they were. And then Percy gets an Iris message from somebody unknown that shows Nico D'Angelo has been camping out at the River Styx in the underworld, and he's been talking to this unknown ghostly figure. And then we also meet the new camp director, Quintus, who's taking over for Mr. D. And he's a demigod, or he's a half-blood also, and he is also the sword instructor, and we kind of sort of suspect something's a bit off with him a little bit. He has a hellhound as a pet and stuff. And then Annabeth tells Percy about the labyrinth. So we find out that the mission that Clarice went on And the last book was actually, she was going through the labyrinth because they suspect that Luke and his armies have been using the labyrinth to get around, and that they want to use the labyrinth to invade Camp Half-Blood. So that's what Clarice was up to. So I'm really glad we followed up on that as well, because it was just kind of a cliffhanger as to what she was doing. So we continue the Clarice storyline a little bit here. And Annabeth, she tells Grover he needs to look in the labyrinth for Pan. And everybody seems to think that that's a bad idea. And so I do like this whole few opening chapters, because we get a lot of good Camp Half-Blood stuff, activities. We see a lot of good things going on. So I really like that. We're like back into the world of Percy Jackson again. And then we get Quintus breaks the campers up into groups of teams of two. And Grover and Tyson get paired up together, which is unusual, obviously. But I think it's good because it helps them sort of bond for what we see later on in the book. And then Percy and Annabeth get paired up. And while they're looking in the forest, they run into Juniper, who's worried about Grover. And before she can warn them about something, she does mention... before she can warn them about something, they actually get attacked by scorpions. And so they get pushed up against a boulder, and then they end up, as they're fighting the scorpions, they end up falling into some sort of cave that appears to have no way out. And there's actually kind of a sweet moment where Annabeth is scared, and she like holds Percy's hand for a moment. But then she immediately sort of figures out where they are, and she looks at the wall, and she finds the symbol of Daedalus, and the way out just appears. And so they climb out the cave, and Chiron tells them that, you know, they think they've been gone for a couple minutes, but they've actually been gone for an hour. And so Annabeth reveals that they have found the entrance to the labyrinth inside Camp Half-Blood. And then also at some point, I think Juniper mentions that she saw Quintus scoping out the entrance to the labyrinth as well. So we're still kind of getting hints that he's maybe not a great guy. And so then Annabeth goes to the Oracle for an official quest, and she decides that she needs to bring Percy, Grover, and Tyson with her into the labyrinth on her quest, despite the tradition of only taking two companions with you. So she's kind of like jinxing them a little bit by not following the rules, but she insists that she needs all three of them with her. And while she's getting her quest, Percy overhears Clarice inside the big house talking to Chris Rodriguez, who we kind of met back in Sea of Monsters, who's working for Luke. And she talks to Chris Rodriguez because he went into the labyrinth for Luke, but he came out a little bit insane. He's a little bit kind of not all there in the mind. And we see that Clarice clearly cares about him. They clearly had some sort of relationship or something, definitely. She cares about him, so it's kind of good to see it a little bit of a different side to Clarice, which I like. But then Percy goes to see Annabeth, who's preparing her maps for the quest, and we get another sweet moment with them where they hug, but it's kind of a little awkward, and Percy, you know, admits he got, like, butterflies in his stomach, so it's cute, and I do like, again, they're just kind of building on those, like, subtle teen moments where they're showing these small moments of affection, but not really knowing how to deal with it afterwards and not knowing what it means. So I do like that. Annabeth is also reluctant to tell Percy the last line of the prophecy, which states that they will go into the maze, the dead, the traitor, and the lost one raise. You shall rise or fall by the Ghost King's hand, the child of Athena's final stand. Destroy with the hero's final breath. And Annabeth doesn't tell Percy the last part of the line, but he suspects that it rhymes with death. And Percy suspects that the Ghost King is probably Nico because he can talk to the dead. And Grover thinks the Lost One refers to Pan because satyrs have never looked underground because they're kind of afraid of it. So we're getting kind of little subtle clues about maybe what the prophecy is about and what's going on. Obviously, Annabeth's the child of Athena, but that could be somebody else. We don't know. Just like, you know, the last book had a few twists with the prophecy as well. We could have a few twists with this one as well. So I do like this prophecy. And then Percy has a dream about Luke talking to Kronos, and then we see the Impusai, the cheerleader, Kelly. She's also talking to Luke, and Luke says that they have a spy that has revealed to them that they are going on the quest into the labyrinth. And Kelly knows that Percy's watching them through the dream somehow, and she, like, ends the connection. I'm not really sure, like, how she knows. Maybe she's, you know, a mythical monster, has some sort of connection with that. like Grover has the empathy link with Percy or something. So that's kind of like an interesting little twist. And you know, these dreams that Percy has are, they're not really dreams. They're really more like him seeing into another person's world, like what's going on with another person. They're not dreams in the sense that, like, you know, they're surreal and they're made up. It's like actual events that are happening that he just sees them when he's dreaming. So I do kind of like we're continuing the Percy dream thing. And then Percy opens an iris message and he sees Nico raising the dead with McDonald's Happy Meals. And it turns out that Percy raises the dead of the ancient Greek hero Theseus. And Nico wants to know if a soul exchange could bring back his sister Bianca, who we saw die in the last book. And so Nico's powers are kind of like increasing. He's like doing more, talking to the dead, raising the dead. He's definitely a son of Hades. And so then Percy tells Chiron about his dreams and about Luke, but he still doesn't tell him about Nico being the son of Hades. But he does tell him about his suspicions about Quintus. So, and Chiron kind of is like, yeah, I can see that too. So, and then Percy, Annabeth, Grover, and Tyson, they go into the labyrinth. And then in the labyrinth, they kind of wander around for a while. They get lost pretty easily. And then they run into Janus, the god of doorways and decisions. He's a two-headed god that tries to trick Annabeth into deciding on which way to go. But then they're interrupted by the goddess Hera, the goddess of marriage, wife of Zeus. And she kind of says she wants to help them. So Janus goes away, and Hera offers them some advice. And Annabeth obviously is like, well, I want to know how to work out the maze. And she's like, well, Percy has the answer to that. And it's kind of interesting. So we do meet Hera, another new god. We meet a couple new gods in this book. And so I like that we see Hera. We do find out that she's maybe not as perfect as she's presenting herself to be in this particular scene. But Percy says he has no idea what she's talking about. He doesn't actually know how to navigate the maze. And so the four of them end up at Alcatraz, the prison in San Francisco, the island prison. And they overhear somebody named Campe speaking in like some ancient language. And they're like an ally of Kronos. And she's trying to convince Briares, the 100-handed one, to join their cause for Kronos. And Tyson can understand the language, and he can do this like translating thing where he like can mimic their voice and stuff. And so he kind of tells, he's like speaking for Campe through him. So, and he's a big fan of Briares for some reason. I don't remember why, but so he wants to help save Briares. And so Percy plays rock, paper, scissors with Briares, the 100 hands he has. And he ends up tricking Briares because Briares is like, I always win because I have 100 hands. I can do, you know, any combination of rock, paper, scissors. But Percy actually pulls out a rock, paper, scissors, like, gun finger. So he tricks him. And they take the monster. They kind of try to escape Alcatraz, but Campe is, like, behind them and everything. And then they kind of trick her, or Tyson kind of, like, battles her a little bit while they go back into the labyrinth through the prison. And they all make it. So once in the labyrinth, Briares decides not to help them. And it kind of upsets Tyson because he really looked up to him. And he's like, why are you being such a coward? You were my hero. And you kind of feel a little sad for Tyson in a bit because he's kind of lost the hero figure that he thought he had. So Briares ends up leaving them. And then Percy has a dream about Daedalus. And we see him and his son Icarus escape King Minos. And we see the wings that Daedalus made, and Icarus, the wings hadn't settled, the seal on the wings hadn't settled, and they took him out too soon. Icarus was flying over the sea, he went too high, the wings started to fall apart, he fell in the water and drowned. And of course Daedalus kind of blames himself a little bit about that, so we get a little bit more insight into the character of Daedalus. We get the classic Greek myth of, you know, Icarus, And we'll see a little bit more of how that plays out through Percy's dreams. But I do like that kind of insight that we get. And then the next day, Percy, Annabeth, Grover, and Tyson find a pit with cheeseburgers and sodas in it. So they know that Nico has been here raising the dead recently. And so then they end up at the Triple G Ranch, where they meet Eurytrian. And he's like the ranch hand. and he takes them to meet Garion, who runs the ranch, and he does have Nico with him. And Garion, you know, has made a deal with Luke to bring him, deliver him Nico and stuff, but Percy obviously wants to keep Nico safe, so he makes a deal. He says, if I can, you know, if I clean the stables for you, the horse stables, you will give us Nico and let my friends go. And so just like the Greek a story of Hercules, him cleaning out the stables, Percy thinks he can clean out the stables as well. And so Percy goes to the river and talks to the river naiad because he wanted to use the river. But the naiad is like upset because the last time she did that, she helped Hercules. And then Hercules used the river, but it like polluted the river. So she's like upset. She doesn't want to help Percy. But she does give him a clue that at one point the whole ranch was underwater. And she gives him, and she shows him the soil, and there's seashells in the soil. So Percy is able to use the ancient seashells to sprout saltwater geysers. And he uses that to clean out the stables. Which is kind of clever, and I do like that. I mean, it doesn't really make 100% sense, because seashells are dry, they don't actually contain the water. But I guess it's activating the water in the soil, I suppose. But it's still kind of a cool little scene of Percy being clever enough to try and clean out the stables and tricking Garion. But of course, Garion goes back on his bargain. He doesn't honor it. He commands Eurydion to capture the kids, but then Eurydion is like super sick and tired of Garon's bossing him around and telling them what to do. And so he actually ends up killing him. And of course, monsters never die permanently. He'll come back in 100 years, they say. And so Eurydion is, like, excited that he can run the ranch the way he wants to now. And he ensures them that they'll be safe there. So Percy he talks to Nico, and then they end up summoning the spirit of Bianca. And Bianca tells Nico that he needs to stop blaming Percy for her decisions and her choices. And we find out that Bianca was the one sending Percy those iris messages of Nico. And that she wants, you know, Nico to be able to move on and put behind his grief and anger. Because he is a son of Hades, you know, he could be very powerful, especially with those emotions. And of course, that upsets Nico. It's kind of interesting that, because I didn't remember if we ever got Bianca referenced her back again. And so I kind of do like following up that she is dead, she can't come back, but she does want to still look out for her brother. So I do like that. And then that night, Percy has another dream about Luke, and he sees Campe come to Luke asking for her revenge on the four of them for the escape at Alcatraz. And Luke is, like, readying the army to go into the labyrinth and attack Camp Half-Blood. And Kelly does know Percy's watching, but she lets him watch this time. And then Percy talks with Grover, and we learn that 7 days have gone by since they've left, because time works differently in the labyrinth. And so Grover's week with the council is up, and so he tells Percy he can't go back to camp unless he does find Pan. And so Percy asks Nico to go with him back into the labyrinth, and Nico decides to stay behind with Eurydion, and he needs to think about everything and what Bianca told him and stuff. So they leave Nico behind, and they go back into the labyrinth, and Eurydion gives them this little spider bug of how to find Hephaestus, because Hera told them they need to find Hephaestus's forge, because he's the one that can find Daedalus, and they need to find Daedalus so that they can navigate the maze. And so Eurydion gives them this little mechanical spider that'll lead them to the Hephaestus forge. And so the four of them head back in the labyrinth, they follow the spider, they end up coming across a sphinx that requires Annabeth to answer 20 questions before the sphinx will let them pass through. And Annabeth is, like, kind of insulted by these easy questions because they're supposed to be challenging riddles, and she's, like, the daughter of Athena, the goddess of wisdom. And so Annabeth kind of offends the Sphinx, and then they end up, like, fighting the Sphinx. And it's kind of, like, a fun little moment. I do kind of like the Sphinx as, like, this, like, kind of fun pop quiz, like, game show personality. I like that aspect a lot. And so they attack the Sphinx and everything, and they end up escaping and going around. And that's kind of where we leave off the first 10 chapters with them on their way to the Forge of Hephaestus. And so I do like the whole first half of this book. I think it's an interesting journey. You know, it's very much follows the formula of the previous books, but instead of, you know, traveling across above ground, we're traveling underground through the labyrinth, and we're ending up in these locations like Alcatraz and the Triple G Ranch and stuff. And so I do kind of like that. I like all the stuff we got at the beginning with Camp Half-Blood. I like continuing Grover's mission. I like the return of Tyson, and he's actually a lot more competent and capable this book. And then I do like the little relationship building we're doing with Percy and Annabeth. And I liked seeing the return of Rachel Elizabeth Dare and Bianca and everything, and meeting new gods like Hera and Janus. So that is all kind of fun and exciting. I liked what we got with the stables and Percy and everything. And so I think this part of the book has been a good job. I think we're getting a little bit better Luke also, even in just the brief scenes that we see with him. He definitely is coming off a bit more of an actual villain, like an active villain type character. I don't know if that will continue, but I do like seeing that, because my biggest complaint is that he's supposed to be kind of our villain for these book series, but we're not really getting enough of him or doing anything with him as a villain. And so I kind of like that. Even in these brief glimpses, we're still seeing him kind of waver a little bit, but he's definitely coming off a little bit more of like taking an active part in leading Kronos' army and stuff. So I do like what we get with Luke here. And I like all the stuff that we're getting, just expanding Greek mythology. We're getting into King Minos and Daedalus and, you know, the labyrinth and stuff. We'll see what's up with Quintus. We don't know yet. So I like that what we got here. I think the first half of the book is pretty good. So that's it for my review of the part one, first half of the book of Percy Jackson and the Olympians, The Battle of the Labyrinth. Stay tuned to the next episode where I review the second half of the book. And then part three will be me reviewing the whole book as a whole, the narrative, the character arcs, and everything, and just kind of my general thoughts on the book. So that's it for this episode, everybody. So thank you all for listening to the Percy Jack Sun Up Poseidon podcast. Bye.